four problems.
Congress has been willing, and also to a certain extent the state and federal governments, to recognize that. And so they've agreed to a number of amendments. The first big set of amendments came in 1974 and 75. And were coordinated again through AFN. There were a number of things that were dealt with. And I'm not sure it's important for you to remember all these, but the tone of them is maybe important. The federal government managed any native lands until the natives get them, even though the natives select the lands, until the lands actually are conveyed and the federal government manages. Some of those lands have existing leases, rights of way, and are making money for the federal government. We said that should be native money. And they said, well, you're probably right, but we got no way to take care of that. We said, well, you can put it in an escrow account. They said, we don't have any authority for an escrow account. So we passed an amendment that says they did have authority, so now there's an escrow account. So an escrow account is where you set aside money, and then when the land is conveyed, the government pays the money out of that.
What type of land did that cover?
It's mostly little stuff, like if they sold a little gravel off the land, or that some guy was leasing a right-of-way. It could be pretty big. In some places on the Kenai Peninsula where there's been oil revenues, it may be a lot of money. Another thing that came up, and it was largely done through NANA, was that NANA said, look, the stuff with the village corporations is presenting real problems. Our village corporations aren't economically viable. They got land out there, they got a little bit of money, there's no real potential for business, and they're going to go bankrupt if we don't do something. Said, aside from that, all it means is that that people are fighting each other, are really fighting themselves, because if you're a village shareholder, you're a regional shareholder. So if the village is arguing with the region, you're arguing with yourself. That's what it comes down to. Because it's the same. I mean, there are more people in a region than a village, but that's what it's all about. So NANA said, we would like to merge our villages into the region and unify them. You said earlier, part of the theory of those people who wanted to undo the Claims Act was you separate it into as many pieces as possible so you got more opportunity for conflict. We felt merger would help undo that. And Congress agreed and allowed villages to merge either among themselves or with their region. NANA was the first to do that. It's since been done in Otna with a region. It's been done in Koniag, which is a source of a lawsuit right now because of how they presented their material. It's also been done in a couple areas just among villages, several villages in the middle of Yukon, Galena, around Galena, merged together. The upper Yukon River villages, the upper Kuskokwim villages merged together and a few others.
Well, he was involved with Clink and Haida in their lawsuit. Clink and Haida took a different road than the rest. They sued in federal court, and he was part of that. They received eventually $7.1 million or something for all the national forest, or all the forests, virtually all the forests in the southeast. As a result of that, when the land claims came along, although they shared equally in the money, the villages, rather than getting a minimum of 69,000 acres in southeast, they all get 23,000 acres. So they lost a lot of land by doing that and got for it. Well, even if you take minimum populations, they lost 400,000 acres down there, and they got $7 million by going sooner. He was involved in that. He was involved in some of the Arctic slope stuff, and he was a figure. I think he was not as important as people like Willie and Emil and Byron and some of those guys, and he was not very active in Washington. He eventually ended up, well, I guess more his brother. He and his brother both suing Arctic Slope because they wanted more money for attorney's fees than the Settlement Act gave them.
Do you perceive problems with going on with the time and death pay taxes for all land in
the No, because I think as long as they don't own the land, they're never going to have to pay taxes on it.
Well, what are they making their money off of now?
They're making their money off of three things. First of all, they're making it off of money, because they have a lot of money that they have not spent, and that's invested, and they're making money off of that. They're making apparently a little bit of money off of their little hotel in Hawaii. They're making a fair amount of money. Now, I'm not from the land management, so I can only tell what I sort of know fully. From a firm called Escatech, which is a surveying firm which is working in Alaska and other places. But I think they're making most of their money off of money because they haven't invested. I'll tell you why, maybe in the next hour, why I don't think they're going to have to pay taxes, because it relates to another amendment.
A couple of summers ago, I worked up in the Brooks Range on mineral exploration, and that was on Doyon land. And they were deriving revenues from that, allowing the mineral companies to set up their camps and then look at the rocks and all that.
Right.
And I was wondering, would that be considered the development of land?
That's a good question. No, actually no, because we changed the law to make sure that exploration was not covered. But that income is considered shareable under 7i.
Yeah.
They got it. Okay. Other amendments that were dealt with, we got exemption.
I was going to ask you, what kind of amendments would you propose for 7i? Like all going to FN or...
Well, could we save that till the end of the class, until the next hour?
Uh-huh.
But I will try to answer it. I don't think I really can, but it's a very difficult question. I don't really know, but I can give you some ideas we've thought about. One of the other things that we did, and we got some exemptions from the Securities and Exchange Commission. The Securities and Exchange Commission regulates stock sales. And they were in the process of requiring some pretty substantial report from us, all of which were expensive to put together because we had to get our accountants and lawyers to do it. Plus, the SEC had mistreated NANA when NANA tried to merge their villages earlier on. And Congress got upset. So they got exemption from the Securities Exchange Commission until 1992 when the stock can be sold because people said, well, you know, why regulate, why have all these regulations on stock that can't be sold? It's just costing people money they don't need. What? It's actually January 1st, 1992 is what the act says. You'll hear both. We use them interchangeably. We also got an amendment that said that if stock was inherited, people didn't have to pay inheritance taxes on it until 1992 because the stock had no value. They couldn't sell it. And why tax people on something that had no value? I suspect we're going to go back and try to deal again with what happens after 1992 because that's still a problem. But that's all we could get in 1975. A lot of that was because of the state because they wanted the money. Well, of course, right now in 1992, the state isn't going to need the money, so it won't be as big a deal for them. Cook Inlet got a big land trade because they didn't have any good land left in their region because that's around Anchorage and Kenai, and most of the good land already was something. It belonged to a borough, or it belonged to the state, or it belonged in a moose range. So they got a big deal that allowed them to select land in places other than their region. And there were some other things. But anyway, it was Congress's first real commitment to say, look, we know there are going to be problems, and if we can have some consensus as to what the solution to the problems are, we'll deal with them. Well, how do you get the consensus? Well, first of all, the native corporations have to agree that they want it. For the most part, Congress would not pass something that the natives themselves didn't want so far. As somebody brought up earlier,
people's feelings about natives change over the course of history, and whether that's always true, I don't know. But at least at this point, they've said that. They also said that really, when you're dealing with native issues, there are four groups that should be involved. There are the natives themselves, there's the state, the federal government, and on some issues, because land is involved, the environmentalists. And they said, basically, if you can come to an agreement with three out of four of those groups on what should be done, we'll probably buy it. And that's a test that was used repeatedly when we went through the D2 bill. You know, it was, if you can get people together to agree. And for the natives and the people in Washington to determine what the natives want, don't call up every region and ask them. They look to AFN. One, because it's a convenience. It's easier dealing with one group than 12. But also because of the reputation that AFN has gained in terms of lobbying for natives' interests. And so AFN is sort of critical in dealing with Washington. Somewhat also in Juneau, particularly with the Claims Act, but less so because people know most of the legislators up here, and you can deal more personally, but certainly in Washington.
What are the four groups again?
The state, federal government, natives, and in some instances, not all, and actually maybe not even most instances, but some, and particularly when land is involved, what you're doing with land, the environmentalists. And that was very true, obviously, during the D2 bill, when we got 37 or whatever as amendments to the Claims Act, because the D2 bill was their bill. And with people like Udall and Tsongas being very key players, if the environmentalists were opposed to it, it was harder to get. Now, we did several times, when we had the support of the state and federal government, do things that the environmentalists didn't want. There are a couple other things that I'd like to say about AFN. It's probably not to this day settled as to what AFN is going to be, and even whether it's going to survive. For instance, the Aleuts walked out of AFN in 1973, I think, or 74, and have never rejoined. It hasn't made a lot of difference to AFN because the Aleuts are not key political players in the state, but they are not in AFN. They obviously receive a lot of benefits. Other regions from time to time question the value of AFN. One regional corporation recently wrote a letter saying, look, we got all these nonprofit corporations out in our area doing housing and health and welfare and working on subsistence and stuff like that. What do we need AFN for? Well, my answer to that is that you need AFN because AFN helped get you your share of $300 million last June, which you would have never gotten on your own. All this tax stuff we've been talking about, and there's a lot more in the D2 bill, is all AFN's. It's all business. But it's the kind of thing where AFN has to prove themselves year after year after year, because it's not what you did for me last year, it's what you're going to do for me next year, because it does cost money. AFN's budget is, I think, around $300,000 to cover the cost of the president and other administration. And regions have to pay that. And it's done on a formula that relates, well, I think every region pays $8,000 and then the rest of the budget is divided up based on how many people you have enrolled in your region. And for a couple of regions like Sea Alaska, that can be substantial. As a matter of fact, at one time, when Calista walked out of AFN for about a year or so, Sea Alaska was paying $50,000 or $60,000. They're paying over 20% of the budget because they got so many people. Arctic Slope has been out, and they're now back in. I guess that's all, but it's still tenuous. And It's particularly become a little more difficult recently because a number of the native corporations have said to themselves, well, we've had a lot of trouble dealing with what people call business. And why is that? Well, that's because we don't know anything about business. We're not businessmen. Now, if we're supposed to be a corporation, what do we do about that? Well, let's go out and hire ourselves some businessmen. And that's what they've done, largely from outside the state. Well, those guys certainly, first of all, have none of the history of AFN. You know, what AFN has brought to the community. Little, if any, political experience. Certainly little recognition of what the power that AFN has in Washington. And so they're saying, look, here's a region and we're not making any money. Or we're only making a little money and we're spending $26,000 on AFN. We're not making any money off of that. We should get out. They're just a political body. What does that have to do with business? Well, it has to do the same thing that the Chamber of Commerce has to do with business, and that's a lobby group, and business pays dues to that. But that kind of thing is hurting AFN. The relationship of AFN to different groups is also unsettled. There's never been a formal association of village corporations with AFN. One, because it's hard to bring 200 and some organizations together in any meaningful way. That's an issue that's been talked about for several years and it's not been dealt with. It is not unreasonable to think that village corporations might set up their own statewide organization someday. And you could again get some real conflicts, even though we're dealing with the same people. But because people have said you're different, people start thinking you're different. There are also other groups that have wanted special recognition in AFN that have been dealt with more on an informal basis, but certainly not too much with representation, definitely not with representation on the board. That's people like the AFN Youth Group, the Elders Conference, the Alaska Native Women's Group, there's an Association of Native Educators, all those who want some kind of recognition from AFN. That's not really been dealt with. On the other hand, one thing that has been dealt with is Native nonprofits. Does anybody here, how many people don't know what Native nonprofit corporations are? Anybody? Oh, okay. Be honest. I mean, the I deal with these things every day. Don't feel that because you don't know about it that you're dumb. I mean, lots of people don't know about it. When the Claims Act passed, it became clear that Native corporations were responsible for land and business development. And for some of us that work in places like NANA, we think for protecting and enhancing Native cultural values. It's part of our responsibility. It's not just making money. But there's still things like health and education, housing and things like that that need to be dealt with, which really business corporations can't deal with. One, because generally we can't get federal funds to do it, and two, we got enough to manage with what we're doing. So in every region, a nonprofit corporation was set up to deal with social needs. There are 12 of those statewide, and I think it was in 1979, AFN added each of them to the board. So AFN has a 23-person board because the Aleuts still aren't in. But they're in on the nonprofit side, but not the profit side. They pay a small fee for joining, but basically the overhead of AFN is carried by the regional profit corporations. That's sort of where AFN is today, and I think it might be appropriate place to break. Oh, I'm sorry.
Is there a village nonprofit?
Not in the same way. I mean, every village didn't set up a nonprofit like every region did. Some dealt with IRAs. The most common form of village nonprofits is what are known as Indian Reorganization Act councils or IRA councils, who get some money from the federal government. Also, many of the villages have city governments that deal with some of these problems, although not all of them. I'm not aware of any village that set up a nonprofit just for under state law. One of the interesting things about the Claims Act is that the villages had a choice. They could be either profit or nonprofit. They didn't have to be profit. The regions had to be a profit corporation. Villages did not. I believe every village chose to be profit. And does anyone know why they chose that? And everyone knows, first of all, that probably almost none of them can be at this point. It's very hard for villages. So why did they choose?
Maybe in order to eventually be able to maintain a value without having to automatically have that value being put back into the village.
No, the reason is a technical one, and that is that if you're a profit-making corporation, you can distribute money directly to each shareholder. If you're a nonprofit, you can't distribute to your members. Perhaps we would have been better off getting a state law that allowed that kind of distribution, and we might have saved a lot of grief down the line. But anyway, that was the reason. All right, why don't we take another... Okay, why don't we take another 5 minutes? And I have wrapped up what I committed to Willie to do. When we come back, I will take questions on that or other things. Or, if you want, I can give you a little idea of what's in the D2 bill that relates to the Claims Act. A couple of routes I can go. I'll sort of leave it up to you guys. I could discuss a little bit of some of the things that are in the D2 bill to change the Claims Act. Or I can take some of your questions, and I suspect from chatting with some of you, if I take some of your questions about the Claims Act or about AFN, I may get at a number of the things that we've changed. My preference is, because I like to operate this way, is that you ask questions. So that means at least you have to think a little out there too. And maybe I'll... But really, it's up to you. I can lecture for another 40 minutes if you want. What? What's he? Yeah, he was president for Frank Ferguson. He is now working for Doyon out of Anchorage, working on developing special projects, some in the construction field, some in the oil industry.
Can you answer my question about that?
Oh, sure. What I would do?
Well, it depends. The problem is there may be a constitutional problem. And let me explain the... If there's a constitutional problem, I'm not sure you can resolve it. What happens with 7i is that Congress has said that people are going to get money. That some of that money that comes in is going to be shared among regional corporations, and all the money that's shared, half of it goes to village corporations. So what Congress has done is they've created a right to that village, or that money, a right in the region and a right in the village. Congress cannot take rights away generally without compensating. So if they do something to change 7i that means somebody gets less money, Congress legally has to pay that difference, and they're not about to do that. Now, it is possible, it is arguable in court that Congress could go back in and change it, because it's a piece of Indian legislation. And it's not a taking because they are dealing with an Indian settlement. There is some precedent in that. It would be a very fine legal argument. And the problem that you have is that I'm not sure Congress wants to gamble. They'll go make a change, and then if the court case goes against them, they got to pay a lot of extra money. There is a way to deal with that, however. Which would be to make the change and then say that change is good as long as it's upheld to be constitutional. It's not, there's no change, then somebody could take the case and federal courts could decide. The problem with doing what, making any change like that is, as a minimum, you got to get the 12 regions to agree with what the change would be. And you couldn't do anything that would totally irritate the villages, because they do get some money. And because if you did, if the Native were split on it, I don't think Congress would be able. Natives could come in together and say, look, this is a big mess. All we're doing is making lawyers rich, and this is what we want to do about it. And we agree Congress to do it. The problem is, who do you go ask how to solve it? Well, you go ask your lawyer, you know? And so one lawyer says one thing and one lawyer says another. And it's been, we have tried literally dozens of times to sit down in rooms with, sometimes just with the management of Native corporations, sometimes with the management and their lawyers, to work something out. And you just, it's just, we've been unable to. The reason, part of it is because, at least under existing law, it says you're supposed to share. The concept was one that was developed by AFN early on when they said, well, look, there always had been a position of AFN that there ought to be some sharing of resources among all natives in the state because it wouldn't be fair to have one or two corporations real rich and everyone else poor. If people agreed with that concept, 7i could be solved tomorrow afternoon. If I could get 12 regional corporation leaders to agree that they're supposed to share and it's good to share, we could set them down in an afternoon or a day or two and solve the problem. Because then it's all technical, you resolve it, you cut some deals, go tell the lawyers to write it up. But you've got regions that basically don't want to share, who don't agree with the concept, who say that's wrong. You know, there are resources. Arctic Slope has been the most diligent in that regard, although Cook Inlet is right up there with them these days. So what they do, in order to get around sharing, they say, yeah, sure, the law says we got to share, and yeah, we got money, but we've got all these deductions, all these costs. So I guess you were asking about, revenue. Well, that's the problem. Net revenue, what is it? How much you can deduct? Well, you know, imagine if lawyers and accountants could make up deductions forever. So what would I do? I don't have a good solution under the existing system. I mean, I don't think there is one unless the regional leadership themselves sit down and say, this has gone too far, we're going to solve it even though we know somebody's going to lose and somebody's going to win. And that's the only solution to it. And it may happen. I mean, I think people are getting sick of it. The problem is that because it's such a complicated issue, what happens is that most of the regional leadership send all the papers to their lawyers and say, you deal with this. I don't understand. I don't know what Cook Inlet's talking about here or what Arctic Slope is talking about. It doesn't make any sense to me. You know, I'm hardly learning about business. Now you want me to be a lawyer and accountant too. You do it. And so, for a couple, well, a number of the meetings that are now being held in court, I go for Nana, we stop sending our attorneys because it costs them so much money. But and some of the other regions have started sending some of their management people. But still, all of them deal with all of the staffs. If there has been some talk by Doyen, I'm trying to come up with a different concept to take it to Congress. But they haven't given us anything to look at.
What about the amendments that were in the D2 bill? How much, what effect do they have? And broaden it even to beyond that, what's the future hold?
Well, that's, I mean, you've asked me the question that I could have lectured 40 minutes on, and I don't want to do that. Let me take a couple areas about and save the other question from the second question for maybe later. There are several key issues we dealt with in the D2 legislation, and let me chat about them. One, the tax thing we discussed. We did several other things with taxes that were sort of interesting. You asked earlier, isn't even with the 20-year extension, isn't Doyon eventually, because they got so much land, going to be taxed out of existence? Well, there are several things that say maybe or maybe not. First is, of course, that if the state continues to get as much money from oil as they do, they're not going to need any land taxation. I
and they'll ask them, they did away with personal income tax, why am I thinking? That's a short-term answer.
But what really is Doyon's salvation is something that we would call the Alaska Land Bank, the D2 bill. And what that does is it says that if a native corporation can sit down, cut a deal with the state government or the federal government, whoever your neighbor is, to manage your land cooperatively, if the natives don't want to develop their land, they won't be taxed on it. Not only will they not be taxed on it, but they can't lose it in a bankruptcy proceeding if they haven't already pledged it. So let's say you've got a village corporation, they got some land, they put it in the land bank, and they go into the airline business and go bankrupt. Well, that land stays. They can't get at it. Banks can't get at it. And in addition, it's free from adverse possession, which is squatter's right. Somebody can't come in and sit on it and then say it's theirs. And what happens with the land bank is your land goes in initially for 10 years. And after that, you can renew for 5-year periods. If you want to take it out, say, put it in for 10 years initially, then five. If you want to take it out, let's say in the 8th year to develop it, if there were any land taxes you would have paid, otherwise you've got to pay those taxes plus some interest. Then if you get into this period and want to take it out, say you take it out in the 4th year, well, the 14th year being in the land bank, the 4th year of this term, you just pay back to here, you just pay 4-year taxes, you don't have to pay all the way back. It's something that is not only, assuming the state wants to do something with it, that could be available to other private landowners too, but native corporations will obviously be the primary beneficiary.
Now from a land protection standpoint,
that's the most significant thing in the bill. From a corp...
That was on the beach.
That was in the beach. From the protection of corporations from outside takeover, which was an issue that was raised by somebody earlier, we have another not quite as successful amendment, but something that I think will help. The D2 bill says that if a corporation wants to amend their articles of incorporation, they can, in order to provide for certain protections, and those protections are basically twofold. One is what's known as a right of first refusal. And how that works is, what's your name? Terry comes along to me, or I come to Terry and say, hey, I know you've got some stock in what corporation?
Yeah.
The Alaska. And Byron's my friend, and I know that's real good stock. So why don't you sell me your shares? I'll give you $1,000. And he said, well, Jesus, you know, the semester's almost over, and I'd sure like to take off to Las Vegas or someplace, and just what I need is $1,000. Well, under a right of first refusal, you would have to go to see Alaska and say, hey, John Scheidman wants to buy my stock for $1,000. Now, Sea Alaska could then do a couple things. They could say, hell no, we don't want John Scheidman buying that stock. We'll buy it. And then they have to give you $1,000. Or they could save you $1,000 that John Scheidman is cheating you. We just had somebody down here in Angoon sell their stock one share for $10,000. He wants all yours for $1,000. Go tell him no. Or they could let you sell it. But anyway, the right of first refusal does allow them to buy up the stock if they don't want the outsider to own it. It is, I think, in the long run, more protection for the shareholder so that you don't get taken to the cleaners by somebody who comes along and says, you know, here, we'll trade you your stock for a new car.
They could, the corporations, because the price of the stock?
No. If I offer $1,000,
That's my price. Corporation has to pay the $1,000 if they don't want me to buy it, or they can pay $1,001 if they want it. They have to meet my price. Now, let's get to the second example. I come to Terry and say, look, I just quit Man and I went to work for Exxon. And Exxon liked to get into the timber business. And we know that Sea Alaska owns timber, so we're busy trying to buy up Sea Alaska's stock. So how would you like $100,000 for your stock? And you go to Sea Alaska and you say, John Shively's working for Exxon and they want to pay me $100,000. Can you match that? And Byron or somebody says, well, Jesus, we don't want Exxon owning our corporation. Yeah, we'll buy your stock. Here's $100,000. Okay, they can do it for you. How many shareholders can Exxon go to before Sea Alaska runs out of money? You know? Exxon has lots more money. So the right of first refusal doesn't totally protect native corporations from takeover. So we have a second thing that corporations can do, and that is they can provide that if stock is sold to a non-native or a non-descendant of a native, that cannot be voted. So if I buy it as Exxon, I can't vote in the election. I can get dividends, but I can't influence how the corporation is run. That will probably work in most cases, but to prevent takeover, but perhaps not at all.
Just the use of mining stock.
Well, that would be just it. They probably wouldn't. Now, and I'm going to get to a third issue on this in a minute. And what really will probably come later for you and then Lincoln.
Okay. If they had to stock and make it and vote it into a presidency or a treasurer or something like that?
Ordinarily, if they, let's say Exxon came in and bought up even 30% of the stock, less than that for a number of corporations. Most corporations have a hard time getting 50% of their shareholders to vote. So Exxon goes and buys 10, 15, 20% of the stock, they start putting people on the board of directors. And that board of directors chooses the president. So that's how they influence it. So they get their board of directors, and they choose a president that they want, and then the president starts running the company.
They pick the board of directors and have the shareholders, or?
Yeah, but see, Exxon's now a shareholder. So they have one of their people.
But even if they're non-voting, they can still be on the board of directors.
Under the existing law, yeah. But they'd have to get themselves on by somebody else putting them on.
Yeah. Well, we are one. Okay, is that going to stand up in courts?
We think so, again, because it's Indian legislation. The purpose of this legislation is to have something for the natives, not to have something for Exxon.
What's to prevent the native fronting for a corporation?
That's another weakness. As I said, this is not as good a solution as we did on the land. That brings me to the point that I don't know whether Willie will make or not. That's a point that's gotten me into a lot of trouble in classes before when I've said it. But I believe it. I know Willie believes it. People like Byron Lott believe it. And that is, we do not believe natives should ever sell stock. That what that stock represents is really the only outward visible sign of being a native. Represents the land ownership, what has been passed on, what people lived here for a long time for. If you start selling that stock, that's it. That's the end. Now, there's going to be a lot of pressure. You know, if you're a poor person sitting in Buckland without enough money to buy fuel, and somebody's going to give you $10,000 for a share in that stock, you're going to have a hard time not selling. But it's only if the natives themselves recognize that the value is there for them as people and ignore the potential economic value can that stock be held. Otherwise, it will probably pass out in native hands. That's my lecture.
I'm not native, I don't have to make the decision. But it's a tough one for those of you that are our shareholders. No question. And probably for those of you in this room, it's going to be less tough because I suspect most of you will be out and doing fairly well, being able to support yourself. You have a lot of relatives and friends perhaps at home that are going to have a lot more problems doing it. Well, that money will be a lot more needed. But it's sort of like when they passed out all the limited entry permits, and a lot of natives got them, and a lot of natives sold them. Now they don't fish them.
I was an answer, but well, it's not really relevant. But I was going to ask, you said not a native person bought that, does it have to be in the same region?
That's really left wide open. We're dealing with that now in NANA because we were the ones who developed the amendment. And I mean, there were some problems. When we developed the amendment, we would have loved to say, one, that these things had to be done, that they were automatically in place. But we had at least one region and probably two who wouldn't go along with that and said, no, our shareholders may not want those kind of restrictions because it makes the stock less valuable when you have those restrictions. So it's optional. We are going to ask our shareholders whether or not they want to confine native or their descendants to really NANA people. The act does not speak to that at all. We believe you could probably do it if that's what the shareholders want.
If NANA bought stock in Sealaski, eventually NANA could buy enough stock in Sealaski to control it.
I think it'd be the other way around because there are lots more people in Sealaski than there are in NANA. The other thing, though, interestingly enough, that stock sale does do that people haven't recognized that has some positive aspects is that it would allow for merger between regions. And again, if you look at my philosophy, which is again a personal opinion, and you're not to take it as fact, but at least it's my opinion that the more people are together, the stronger they are. Generally, if you're in business, the bigger you are, the better you are. Now, the fact that Chrysler's going bankrupt and American Motors isn't sort of says that you can still be bigger and mess up, but still, generally, if you're a little bigger, you're probably a little stronger.
Is there any way legally for a corporation could have the people that are stockholders put the land in trust held by the corporation in perpetuity?
Have people do what?
People that the corporation can hold the people's land in trust.
Well, we're dealing with stock. Most of the land is owned by the corporation. They already have it in trust. And a corporation has a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders to manage that land well. So it's already in trust. It's the stock that can be sold to other people.
And there's no counterpart for the stock to be held in trust.
Well, people could do it. I mean, there are ways to do that. But it would all be voluntary, and I doubt there would be any way to say that people couldn't take it out if they wanted.
Yes, sir, good question. On an easement, instead of trying to sell it to them, could you charge like a toll at the bridge?
Well, that's what easements usually are. You're giving up, in land, there's what there's called a bundle of rights. There are lots of things. If you have an easement,
you have a lot, you got an easement to get across here, you're just giving people the right really to walk. You're not giving them the right to dig up, unless maybe you did it for an underground power line.
Well, what I was saying, you would make money off of them by tolling.
Well, you don't have to toll. The problem with easements with the native corporations is they were taking them for free. So this easement is on here when the natives get their land, so they can never charge for it. Okay, let's say there's no easement.
and the federal state government comes along and says, look, we need to get from here to there. You can say, well, that's fine. You'll pay us. It wouldn't be a toll. It would probably be every year or every quarter they'd give you a little bit of money. But you can charge for an easement. The problem with what federal and state governments want to do, they want to take them all for free.
Yeah, you're not buying that. You're just renting it, right?
Yeah, and maybe someday they'd come along and say, we're tired of paying you, we don't need it anymore, and they wouldn't have their easement anymore.
Do they have the right to build roads there?
If that's what the easement says. There are all different kinds of easements. Most of the easements are trail easements to get across state lands to federal and state lands, and on a trail easement you can't go and build a road. I mean, they would have to come in and get a new easement, and then they'd have to pay you. There are some road easements, but generally the concept was that you got the easement for what was there. So if there's no road there, there's no easement.
What's an
airport? Well, I sure hadn't asked that. Airports are a real problem. Mostly airports already exist, and mostly they'll be granted to the state. Some of it will eventually probably will be done by people.
I know that there's been a lot of money given to the corporations, and some of them haven't been giving the money back to the shareholders. See, Alaska has been doing that. They'll get appropriated a bunch of money from the federal government, and they give it probably into the native, their people, in the form of dividends. My husband is a boy on Robert Keeley, and they got a lump sum of money, and instead of giving it to the people, they kept it themselves, and he was talking about somehow trying to get the money from them. Is there any protection, or can he do
no,
that?
No, that's what's supposed to be done. That's what's supposed to be done.
He was talking about suing them because...
I would tell him to save his money, because that's what the law says is supposed to happen, because you're not in a building. And that's the difference. If you're not in a village, what happens is, let's say Sea Alaska gets $100 for each shareholder, okay? The deal is they keep 50 for themselves, and they give 50 to one of two places. You either give it to the village corporation, essentially the shareholders in the village corporation, his $50 goes to his village corporation. The shareholders not in the village corporation, then it goes to the at-large shareholder. And that's what the law says. Now, they don't even have to give you that. They could withhold some that no corporation has. But the idea is, if this village corporation passes all that money out, it'll be bankrupt. And if that corporation invests that money and does well, he'll be getting dividends down the road. Mm-hmm. And because, well, but some village corporations are. Do you know who's paid the biggest dividend so far?
I think ours, right? Sea Alaska.
That's not a dividend you got.
Oh, okay.
You didn't get a dividend. You got what every at-large shareholder in the state got, whether it was Nana or Sea Alaska or anyone else. The biggest payment in the states come from a village corporation in the southeast that has timber. The Vilco. They pay $25,000 to each shareholder.
We got 27.
100.
Yeah,
25,000. Approximately 10 times. The shareholders could vote to make them give the money away.
That's what they're doing right now.
But, you know, if you want to make your village corporation fail, fine. Now, what happens is you got that big check, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to get one more check like that. You're going to get it next fall, and then that's it. Now, down the road, he will, if this corporation is ever successful and makes money, years from now, he'll be getting dividends. And you'll be getting nothing, because his money stayed in here and grew and was invested. Now, if the corporation folds, obviously, you don't get it. What happens in Nana, for instance, we've paid a small dividend the last 3 years, is if you're a merged village, you merge with Nana, you all of a sudden have 200 shares, so they get, if we pay $75 dividend, they get $150. Whereas the people that didn't merge and the at-large people each get $75 or half. But see, the dividend relates directly to the ownership of shares. So you're doing real well right now, but your husband could do much better than you 10, 15 years from now, and your children and grandchildren.
The $50 that went up into our corporation, when we get dividends from that?
If they invest it well.
Uh-huh.
But see, he will also get his dividend up here from Doyon, and he can get another one down here. Well, all you're going to get is up here, because you already got all your stuff through it.
I didn't know.
Most people didn't know what, yet, but it's, they did not pay you a dividend. They paid you a payment that was required. The only reason you got that one big check was because we got all that money from the state last year. We got $300 million in one payment. Because of things like that, I think some of us wish we hadn't. It's caused a lot of confusion. The village shareholders are all real upset.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the way the act was intended to work.
You wish that there wasn't an at-large then?
Well, I would, yeah. But that big amount of money has really made it much more difficult than it was.
We just kind of guessed, like, half of our family went that way and half of them, you know, we didn't really...
Well, who knows? I mean, really, who knows? I mean, you may be right. I mean, you may have gotten your money out early, and if
the corporation
goes under, then he's...
Yeah. Which seems to be what the problem with Keeley, if he's not in debt again. They've been in debt from day one, and they're slowly staying down.
But, you know, the Nana, that's the Nana, right?
Uh-huh.
You know, down, you know, you look at 10, 50 years, it's a rail town. A lot of things that could happen there that when they start being able to use their land, it changed that around.
Mm-hmm.
But who knows? I can't tell you who's right. But that's the way the act was intended to work. I got Lincoln said.
There's a lot of villages that are afraid of merger. Like Nana's really encouraging it. There's a lot of fears that you're hearing and that you're doing. What are some of the fears, and how do you respond to those?
Well, there's several fears. One, of course, is sort of one I don't buy, but as people have something, so they don't want to give it up. We did merger early, and so I think a lot of people didn't understand what they had in the first place, so they didn't know what they were giving up, so it didn't make a lot of difference. I think the biggest argument against it concerns whether or not shareholders feel they can control the management. And if, of course, the region goes down, everybody. That's the biggest argument against it. I mean, you're putting all your eggs in one basket. I just happen to think it's a better basket. And it's, you know, it's just got more staying power. But, you know, again, with bad management, I could be wrong. But if everybody merges, and of course, that's not happened in any region yet, but if all the village people merge, then essentially they're all the same, and they have the same interests. Right now, you've got instances in Koniag where they're fighting with at least one of their villages that didn't merge. The feeling in Otna with the one village that didn't merge is not very good. We get along pretty well with Kotzebue. One of the reasons they didn't merge is they were real big. They had
1,800 shareholders, which is bigger than Otten and almost as big as Chugach is a region in terms of the money on that. I think that's the main item to put all that in there.
Just a fear of collapsing. If a region collapses and the villages still have their own corporations intact, then that village corporation still controls their subsurface land.
No.
The village, you mean their surface land, but the subsurface mineral rights could go down with the corporation.
You know, and even though $1 billion sounds like a lot of money, and I read certainly a number of years ago, it doesn't sound, as you said earlier, I think, so much now. And that's all split up, that money, all over the place. And at least in terms of operating the corporations, for the time being, that money is what makes them go. And one of the things about merger is you're combining not just land, but you're combining money. You got more money to work with. Now, Man has been somewhat successful economically. We would not have been as successful if we had not merged. And we've been able, because we have more capital, to do things we couldn't have done otherwise. There's no question about that.
If you do have it, isn't it going to cost you land? And you find someone in violation of it, say, for instance, someone cutting wood or someone hunting on it. What kind of punishment could you put on it?
Well, it's real. Our trespass laws aren't real good. But the best thing you can do is probably tell them to stop. If he doesn't, if there's a cop around, you can arrest him and charge him with trespass, in which case he'll probably be told not to do it again.
I've written a book that says that you can fine him no more than $500, 6 months in prison, or more.
Well, yeah, it's a misdemeanor. That's the maximum. I would be real surprised, unless the guy was blasting away at little children, that they'd give him anything. You know, if he was cutting some firewood, they'd say, hey. And they might say, look, you cut $50 worth of firewood, you paid for that firewood. But you know, if you call, it's got to be a real problem. That's another reason why we wanted to cut down easements, because the more you got, the more enforcement problems you got. And the federal government, who at one point promised us, oh, we'll help take care of that, is now, of course, backing off and saying, well, it's not our responsibility. You know, we will say that there's an easement here, and what all that guy can do is hike or walk or run a snowmobile across that easement. That's what the easement says. But if he decides to run a tank across that easement, it's not our responsibility to do anything about it. And that's their position. If the tank is destroying trees, then, you know, the village or region could go against them.
Well, if we have a road that goes across, does that mean you can't use cars on it, or what?
Well, if it's just a trail, you can't use cars. If it's a road easement and the road's there, you can use cars. Are you done?
No, we also have some problems too. They said that 25 feet off the side of the road belongs to the mountain.
No, not anymore. Well, I take that back. On road easements, they are wider because of need to expand, and sometimes they are wider than the road. That is correct. It varies from area to area. But they could widen the road.
With the village corporations, wouldn't it be possible that even if, like, they did phase out in one sense and did become financially broke or whatnot, that if a resource started to be developed, that the money would then come back up where they could develop it, or like restart a village corporation 5 or 10 years down the road?
Well, it depends on what they got left. Yeah, but what's key is the land. They go bankrupt and lose the land.
Yeah, that's what I think, that if they could avoid the land from the bankruptcy somehow.
Yeah, I mean, if they've got the land tucked away in the land bank and their airline goes bankrupt, yeah, they can fiddle around and hope that bunch of us strike oil and they'll get money through 7i. But whether that'll work or not. And again, what good it will do the individual shareholders is the other issue. And there are several ways that shareholders can benefit from the Claims Act, one of which is that corporations make money and pay dividends. And the more you got that money spread out into little piles, the less chance there are of making profit. I know you haven't because I'm pretty familiar with CLS's operations. And they didn't even become profitable until the past year. Unless they just paid one, they might have just paid one. I don't think they lost a lot of money.
About equal, could you possibly change over to a village corporation if it's, you know, about equal, and pay all your dividends
back?
Because I didn't really know
what
was going on.
No, the problem is, at this point, there's nothing you can do about it.
Uh-huh. Now, later on, you know, let's say you're an at-large shareholder like yourself. Mm-hmm. Now, do you have any family ties in any villages in Southeast?
Family ties, yeah.
Which village?
Which village, you know?
Okay, well, let's say we get to 1992, and you say, and you know, you're not getting any more of this money anymore, and Huda, who's a pretty big corporation, they got some timber and they're making money, and you decide you want to get into Huda. There are a couple ways. One, of course, you could buy it. And I think another way is your aunt or grandmother or mother or cousin or somebody could give you some stuff. Say, look, you know, you can inherit it, or they can just outright give it to you. So you could get back into a village. You probably won't get back in with 100 shares like you have in the region, but you could get back into something.
Is stock subject to inheritance tax?
It's not until 1992, but it is after that. It's
one of the outstanding issues that I'm not completely happy about. I think that we have an ability to change that if we can develop, particularly if it's inherited from native to native, that we can persuade the state and Congress that it's just against all reason to take the stock away from natives if all it's doing is going to other natives. On the other hand, if I buy some stock and I inherit, and my children, which I don't have any of yet, but should I have any, they were inherited, then I see no reason why they shouldn't be inheritance tax. I'm not sure there should be a blanket exemption, but certainly when it stays in the family or it's given to other natives, I don't think it should be taxed. And I think we can do that. If we had given it more thought, I think it's an issue we could have dealt with in the D2 bill, but we didn't.
Is there any formula for valuation of this?
At this point, there isn't. Of course, it's irrelevant at this point because there is no inheritance tax. There are a number of ways to try to do it, and I don't know which ones the IRS would choose. I mean, in most cases, it's market value. It's what the stock is selling for in real life. Like if I die and somebody inherits my General Motors stock, which I don't have either, there's a value because they just look at what it was selling for on the day I died, and that's how much it's worth. If there's not a lot of activity in the share in native shares, it's going to be harder to determine, but there are some formulas for determining it. One of the problems in valuing stock is probably the biggest asset for any native corporation is its land. And how do you value the land? I mean, I don't know what it's worth. All right, it's 6 o'clock. I appreciate your patience. 3 hours is a long time, and it's been real enjoyable for me. I hope a little bit for you.